part of the upset over President Trump's planned political rally Saturday in Tulsa is that the city is the sacred site of an event 99 years ago when a white mob massacred hundreds of blacks and burned down Tulsa's thriving so-called Black Wall Street. Last year, we spoke to Brenda Alford. Her grandparents lived through the massacre after they ran for their lives.
My grandparents went to one of the parks that was further out and stayed there until they felt like it was okay to come back, only to find their homes and their businesses looted and burned to the ground.
Just like that, a generation of wealth wiped out. And that's not the only time. Elsewhere in the program, we talked about today's huge black-white wealth gap. Let's hear more now about the systemic economic racism that led to that. With William Darity, professor of economics and African-American studies at Duke. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And start where you say this racial divide starts. Of course, there was slavery. In its aftermath, former slaves after the Civil War were promised 40 acres of land and a mule. That did not happen.
No, that did not happen. Actually, the process of delivery of the land grants was undertaken, but it was reversed. When General Sherman reached Savannah, Georgia, at the end of his march through the state, he met with a group of black leaders, primarily composed of ministers. And Sherman asked them, what did they want to have happen? And their response was, give us land to farm and leave us alone. Mm-hmm. And so Sherman issued General Orders Number 15, which provided a swath of land stretching from South Carolina to northern Florida that was supposed to be allotted to the formerly enslaved. But if you look at the full range of land that was supposed to be assigned to the formerly enslaved, there was only a very small share of the total that was actually distributed. And by the end of the year, President Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, reversed the policy that had been embedded in Sherman's special order and had the land that had been allocated up to that point restored to the former slaveholders. And this happens at the same time that the Homestead Acts are being mobilized to provide 160 acres lots to many white Americans in the western part of the United States in territories that had been appropriated from the native population, while the formerly enslaved received no form of restitution. And I would argue that that's the beginning of the contemporary racial wealth gap in the United States. But to compound that, you had a situation for a period of about 80 years in which an array of white massacres that took place in the United States, both North and South, destroyed black lives, destroyed black property, and in many instances resulted in the appropriation of black property by white Americans who engaged in mob violence.
I'm going to tick through some of them. We mentioned Tulsa. But before that, 1912, Forsyth County, Georgia, white mobs drove out an estimated 1,000 or so black residents. Author Patrick Phillips calls this racial cleansing. Back further, 1873, Colfax, Louisiana, about 150 black men murdered for trying to gather at a courthouse. 1906, Atlanta massacre. Whites there, again, threatened by black success stories, a white mob murderously attacking the community. The Elaine, Arkansas massacre, 1919, black sharecroppers wanted to form a union, enraging whites who slaughtered black men, women, and children.
Yeah, 1919 was what was described as the Red Summer, where there were upwards of 36 of these massacres that took place north and south. Not only does it include Elaine, Arkansas, but it also includes northern cities like Chicago, where there was a major, highly destructive riot that took place.
Well, most of these attacks were launched under the false claim that a black man had dared to touch or look at or assault a white woman. Hence, by the way, the uproar over Amy Cooper's threat to a bird watcher in Central Park to say an African-American man was assaulting her, which he wasn't. I mean, that had historic echoes for so many. But it does seem like that was always cover for what these were really about, which was stopping black economic progress.
Yeah, but you know, there are also some interesting exceptions to that pattern. The Chicago case was precipitated by a 17-year-old black man swimming across this imaginary line that was functioning as a boundary in Lake Michigan between where blacks could swim and where whites could swim. And he was stoned to death by whites when black folks on the shore attempted to retaliate for his execution. That's when the white mobs were enraged, and they destroyed large portions of the black community, burning down and shattering homes that I think probably amount to a value of anywhere between $1.5 billion to $3 billion in current currency.
Imagine if families had those homes for several generations or were able to sell those homes and the wealth that accrues from that. But all of that gets stopped in all of these events. Another thing that happened post-Civil War, Reconstruction, there was like a whole new system of enslavement set up through this phony fee system, whereas if blacks could not pay certain fees, they were in effect re-enslaved and sent to work in factories that were in on this deal. They were getting these free workers.
Yeah, and this is embodied in a series of laws that we now refer to as the Black Codes. These laws essentially controlled black family life, black mobility, and they were designed in such a way that not only did they determine which occupations blacks could be channeled into, but they also prevented black workers from leaving jobs unless it was at the discretion of the white employer. It was a form of re-enslavement.
Fast forward, redlining in the 1930s, the Federal Housing Administration would not insure mortgages in black neighborhoods. So there's not the mobility that's needed for economic progress. Talk about some of the other forces. I mean, I understood once that the GI Bill that helped my father and so many buy a home, that returning black veterans didn't get that?
That's correct. Certainly, they didn't get it to the same extent that returning white veterans did. But I think that this process of constraining black capacity to attain home ownership begins in part with the institution of restrictive covenants. So restrictive covenants essentially said certain home properties could not be sold to black folks. When restrictive covenants are declared illegal, that process is supplanted by redlining. The designation of certain neighborhoods as being unworthy of credit access. And then, as you mentioned, you have the introduction of the GI Bill in the aftermath of World War II. Southern white legislators in Congress insisted that the bill be designed in such a way that it would be administered locally. And local administration of the bill meant that local whites could control who would get the resources among veterans from the bill. So the political scientist Ira Katznelson demonstrates in his book, When Affirmative Action Was White, that if we looked at the state of Mississippi, there were only two returning black veterans who received the benefits of the GI Bill for the purposes of buying a home. So you had racially discriminatory application of the GI Bill, which is another way in which you separated the access and opportunity to upward mobility on the part of blacks and whites.
It's really pretty stunning. Roadblocks everywhere. Someone sticking their foot out to trip you economically everywhere. And your research shows that black homes now, with a head earner who's a college grad, have less wealth on average than white homes led by high school dropouts, primarily because there's been no accrued wealth. And your study on the color of wealth in Boston was part of a big Boston Globe. They used your research as part of a project. It showed that black homes had, on average, total life savings, $8, as opposed to a little over $250,000 for white families. And again, that's attributed to, you know, not having the value of a home, or, you know, not having the accrued wealth of generations behind it. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it's staggering, and it's devastating. it would be a very different world, I think, had initially the formerly enslaved actually received at least the 40 acres. If 40 acres had been distributed to all of the newly emancipated blacks, we're talking about an allocation of 40 million acres of land. So that didn't happen, but neither did Sherman's more abbreviated allocation of 5.3 million acres. So the capacity to transfer resources across generations was deeply stunted for Black Americans.
William Darity, professor of public policy and African American studies and economics, and director of the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
He joined us by Skype. And by the way, for the reasons Professor Darity just outlined, he is a staunch supporter of reparations. His new book makes that case. It sounds terrific. And we'll link you at herenow.org.